We are on holy ground in the section of Mark that we're in. It's a section where Jesus goes through the suffering, the death upon the cross. He has been in the Garden of Gethsemane. One of my favorite places in Israel is the Garden of Gethsemane. I like it because there are still some portions of it that you can go to and it's pretty much untouched. There's olive trees there, there's flowers there. The landscape is pretty much what it would have looked like a couple thousand years ago. And you can just go there and hang out and pray. They haven't managed to build a church over it yet, thank God. It's untouched. It's beautiful. A few years back, on my third trip to Israel, I was living in California, and I brought a group with me, and I couldn't wait for a couple of my friends to join me. I had been there a little bit earlier than they were, and knew my way around pretty much, and they came to Jerusalem one night. Came about midnight, and we were close to the walls of Jerusalem, close to the Jaffa Gate. They had never been there before. They were just excited. They got to the hotel, unpacked. By this time, you know, it was a little after 12 midnight, dark. I said, hey, let's take a walk. I say, all right, hey, you know, I can't sleep anyway. I'm so excited. So I walked them around the city of Jerusalem. They didn't know where they were going, but we walked from the upper city around where the upper room was and took the same basic walk that Jesus would have taken his disciples on after the Last Supper. From the upper city, the upper room, down through the Kidron Valley, across the Kidron Valley. When I finally stopped, and where we were was dark, you could see the walls of Jerusalem lit up. I said, you guys know where you're at? They go, I have no idea, but this is awesome. I said, you're sitting in the Garden of Gethsemane. And they just broke down. Wow. And we had one of the most terrific prayer meetings that night, just the three, four of us. Just praying in the place that Jesus prayed and contemplating what it was like for what you might call the greatest battle ever fought. As Jesus prayed, Lord, if it's possible, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not my will, but yours be done. Just thinking about that. And that he had us in mind when he prayed. In fact, John 17 is the high priestly prayer of Jesus Christ. And as he prayed, he also prayed not only for his disciples, but beyond his disciples into history. I pray not only for these, but everyone who will believe on me through their word. He had you in mind in that garden. And he went to the cross. He embraced fully the work that his Father had for him to do. Just awesome to think about that. Well, it was also the place that Judas betrayed him. It was also the place that Peter, James, and John fell asleep on him in. After the Garden of Gethsemane, Jesus was led to the upper city of Jerusalem, probably passing through Stephen's Gate, up through the Damascus Road area, and then off to the left in the present-day Jaffa Gate, where he went to Caiaphas's house. The enemies of Christ were having a fire. Jesus was going through a trial before the high priest, the Jewish elders called the Sanhedrin. Peter was warming himself in the courtyard. Warming himself at the enemy's fires. Now, at one time, you'd never catch Peter around these folks. Now he feels comfortable enough to kind of have a marshmallow roast with him, warming his hands, warming himself, take the evening chill out of the air. And a girl comes to him, a servant girl, asking him some pointed questions. And then is fulfilled exactly what Jesus told Peter. That before this night is over, Peter, you're going to deny me three times. No, Lord, I'll never deny you. You can count on me. I'm always there. Remember, I'm the rock. You named me that. Now, I've named you a little stone, a little pebble. And you're going to kind of float away tonight, Peter. And so we read about it in chapter 14. We didn't quite finish it. Let's go through it and get on into 15. Verse 51. A certain young man followed him, having a linen cloth thrown around his naked body, and the young men laid hold of him, and he left the linen cloth and fled from them naked. That's none other than young Mark, no doubt. And they led Jesus away to the high priest, and with him were assembled all of the chief priests, the elders, and the scribes. Peter followed at a distance right into the courtyard of the high priest and sat with the servants and warmed himself at the fire. Now the chief priests and all the council sought testimony against Jesus to put him to death, but found none. For many bore false witness against him, but their testimonies did not agree. Then some rose up and bore false witness against him, saying, "We heard him say, 'I will destroy this temple made with hands, and within 3 days I will build another made without hands.' But not even then did their testimony agree. And the high priest stood up in the midst and asked Jesus, saying, 'Do you answer nothing? What is it these men testify against you?' But he kept silent and answered nothing. Again the high priest asked him, saying, 'Are you the Christ, the Mashiach, the Son of the Blessed?' Jesus said, 'I am. And you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of power and coming with the clouds of heaven.'" That's right, I am He. In fact, you're going to see me judging you one day. Oh, you think I'm on trial right now? You think you are the great attorney against me in this case? You're going to see me on the right hand of the Son of God. In other words, in judgment, the trial will be upon you, not me. Well, that was enough for them. The high priest tore his clothes, which was sort of mandatory whenever there was blasphemy involved. And he said, "What further need do we have of witnesses? You've heard the blasphemy. What do you think?" And they all condemned him to be deserving of death. Now, here's the problem. They say he's deserving of death, but some years before, the right that the Jews had to condemn a man to death and carry out the death sentence had been removed by the Roman government. Now, this really upset the Jews, but they really had no choice. They could not have a verdict. They could not have a court, a trial, find somebody guilty of blasphemy and put him to death. They lost the power. Death sentences could now only be carried out by the Roman government. And religious cases really weren't their bag. It had to be a political insurrection or a murder or something political, something social. They didn't hear religious cases. It put them in a bind. You should also know, some of the ancient writings tell us, in fact, Josephus mentions it, that when the Romans took away the political right of the Jews to execute capital punishment, that some of the priests put on sackcloth and ashes, and they made a procession around Jerusalem, and they bewailed the fact that God had broken his promises to Israel, quoting the book of Genesis, chapter 49, which says that the scepter, the rulership, the right of governing will not depart from the kingdom of Judah until Shiloh, or the Messiah, comes. And so the priest, the scribe said, "Look, God has forsaken the promise. The right of the scepter, the right to execute capital punishment, has been stolen from us by the Romans. We no longer can mandate in our own cases. We no longer can make this kind of legislation. God has forsaken us. The scepter has departed. Shiloh has not come." Little did they know that at that very moment, there was a man in Nazareth who had been raised up by a poor mother and father who was about ready to lay down his carpenter's tools and march to the Jordan River. And shortly thereafter, he did go to the Jordan River, where John the Baptist met him as the Lamb of God who takes away the sins of the world. The Messiah had come. He was in their midst, as predicted by the prophets. But many of these people missed it. So they condemned him to be deserving of death. Now they're in a bind. They've got to do something. They want to make sure that he gets killed. So here comes the court that involves the Roman government. "Some began to spit on him, to blindfold him, to beat him, to say to him, 'Prophesy.' The officers struck him with the palms of their hands. Now as Peter was below in the courtyard, one of the servant girls of the high priest came. When she saw Peter warming himself, she looked at him and said, 'You also were with Jesus of Nazareth.' But he denied it, saying, 'I neither know nor understand what you are saying.' And he went out on the porch, and a rooster crowed. And the servant girl saw him again and began to say to those who stood by, "This is one of them." But he denied it again. And a little later, those who stood by said to Peter again, "Surely you are one of them, for you are a Galilean, and your speech shows it." Now, what does she mean by that? She meant by that that those in Jerusalem could detect a hick. That's what it means. Those that spoke Hebrew or Aramaic or Greek, who spoke in Jerusalem, spoke differently than those from the back country of Galilee. The Galileans had their own accent. You could just tell that they were from somewhere else than Jerusalem. And there was a distinct Galilean accent. You know what it's like when you're around somebody, say, from Texas? No offense if you're a Texan tonight. Or if somebody from the South, you can kind of pick up accents. It's interesting. In fact, I was over in England. Walked into a pastry shop one morning. This is years ago. In fact, it was on one of my trips to Israel. And I was in England, and I was watching the guy who was selling the donuts across the counter. There was a lot of different Americans that were in the shop that day. And he was able, as they would order, to tell them what part of the United States they were from, what state they were from. New Jersey, then Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, New York. And he was just going on, and I thought, this guy's really good. So I decided I'll put on one of my accents to see if I can fool him a little bit. So I put on my English accent. Now, I shouldn't have done that because he was British, but I thought, you know, I'll put on my English accent, you know. So I said, well, you know, I'd like a cup of coffee. And, you know, I tried to do it the best I could and went on and on. And he looked at me and just kind of shook his head and said, "You're from California, right?" Just like that. Just sharp. Could tell the accent. "You're one of his followers. Your speech betrays you. You've got that hick, Galilean accent. I can spot it." And he began to curse and swear. Now, in the Greek language, this means a very vehement, demonstrative cursing and swearing. To solemnly swear and actually to say, "God, strike me dead if I'm lying." That's the word, a very strong word. As if he would say, "I'm telling you the truth, may God strike me dead if I'm not telling the truth." Can you imagine? This is Peter. "Lord, I'll never leave you or forsake you. Though all others do, you can count on me." Now he's cursing and swearing that he doesn't even know him. "I do not know this man whom you speak." A second time the rooster crowed. Then Peter called to mind the word that Jesus said to him, "Before the rooster crows twice, you will deny me three times." And when he thought about it, he wept. The word for weep is to weep convulsively, out loud, with deep remorse. In some cases, to throw oneself to the ground in mourning. He had great grief of heart. One of the other gospel tells us that when the rooster crowed again, that Jesus turned and looked at Peter, maybe from a window, a lattice, out into the courtyard. There's Peter, there's the fire. And Peter's, "I don't know him, may God strike me dead." And he looked up and saw Jesus looking at him. And he broke. I've often wondered what kind of a look that was. As I mentioned last week, I don't think Jesus was standing there going like this. Or it was any kind of an angry or hateful look. I think it was a look of love, empathy for Peter, knowing what he was about to go through in the next few hours after denying his Lord. That's why he said, "Satan has desired you, Peter. He wants to sift you like wheat. But I have prayed for you, and when you are restored, strengthen your brethren." In other words, look, I know you're going to blow it. You're going to blow it big time. You're going to blow it so bad that I've had to pray for you, and you're going to need to be restored. And when you go through this experience of denying me, Peter, and you're restored, I want you to use it for other people. I want you to restore your brethren. I want you to teach people all about this experience. So he just predicted the whole thing. Now we get into the dealing with the Roman government. In chapter 15, the courts. We have before us a courtroom scene. We've already had one with the Sanhedrin. Now the Sanhedrin, or what we've read about in chapter 14, these are Jewish leaders. Now the Roman leaders come into view. Pilate, the procurator of Judea. The soldiers, and the whole crucifixion scene. It's a full-blown courtroom scene. You've got a prosecuting attorney, you have Jesus, and he really has no defense. A truth is its own best defense, but he really doesn't say anything. You could call it Sanhedrin versus Christ, 33 or 32 AD. Jesus stands before them. And what's interesting about this, you got to put all the Gospels together. Matthew has a fascinating explanation of Pilate's reaction through this whole thing. But it seems like everybody involved tries to rationalize Jesus Christ away. The Sanhedrin does it. Pilate does it. Barabbas. And everybody involved is rationalizing away Jesus Christ. Man has an almost infinite capacity to rationalize, to come up with excuses. Well, it's not my fault, and it's this and that, and they did this, and there's always an excuse, always a rationale. And they do that here in the case with Jesus Christ. But wouldn't you hate to have, like Pilate has throughout all of history, to be known as the one who sentenced Jesus to death? That's his infamous title that he must carry through all of history. Verse 1. Immediately in the morning, the chief priests held a consultation with the elders and scribes and the whole council. They bound Jesus, led him away, and delivered him to Pilate. Now, you ought to know that there were certain rules for a trial. Rule number one. In any kind of a criminal trial, you could never hold it during a high feast season, like Passover. You had to wait till the festivities were out of the way. This is right in the middle of Passover season. It's at Passover. They violated that rule. Rule number two, you could never end a trial on the same day you'd begin it. Unless clearly the criminal was shown to be innocent. If he was innocent, you'd dismiss the case on the same day. But in all other cases, if you suspected this guy to be guilty, you could never end the case the same day you began it. In fact, the law required that you'd sleep on it at least one night. Why? So that feelings of mercy would arise in your heart. You wouldn't be quick. Now, I think that's a good law. Yet I think we've kind of carried it way to the extreme. We kind of wait 40 years before we hear cases. We let them drag on and on and on. The Bible says, when the sentence for a crime is delayed and not carried out swiftly, the people have it in their hearts to do evil. They know they can get away with it. And in our society, you can get away with anything. You can throw people out of a truck and beat them, silly, and you can get by with it. It's not executed speedily or not even at all. So, the Sanhedrin violates its own rules in the trial. And some of them know Pilate, and they're going to use Pilate to get what they want. You know, it's been said about American law that if you can't find a lawyer who knows the law, find one who knows the judge. And they clearly had somebody on the inside track who knew Pilate, and they went over to Pilate and got him involved. And so the scribes and the whole council, they bound Jesus, and they took him across now from Caiaphas's house down to the northern part of the city, to where Pilate was in the Antonia fortress. Now, Pilate was the governor of Judea, the procurator. He dealt directly with Rome. Rome gave him the whole province of Judea under his jurisdiction. Jerusalem was not his headquarters. In fact, they stayed out of Jerusalem as much as they could. They didn't like it. It was too religious. The Roman headquarters for Rome, the Roman procurator, was right by the ocean, Caesarea by the sea. And if you ever go to Israel, you'll see why, man. It's a great spot. The amphitheater is still there today. It's been uncovered and restored and just laid out by the sea. You can see why Pilate and the Romans would want to stay there. Beach breeze. In fact, I've been there on good days where the waves are just breaking. A nice little right, you know, right off. In fact, one day I went out there with a buddy of mine and we surfed like for 4 hours. It was great. Surfing Caesarea. Anyway, getting away from the story. Pilate, every time there was a high festival, Passover, Pentecost tabernacles, he would go to Jerusalem with a lot of troops because there were so many Jews in that temple area and it was so packed full of people. Anything could happen. Riots could break out, and the Jews were well known for their riots. So you'd make sure that you had a large company of Roman soldiers. They were stationed at the Antonia Fortress, which butted up against the temple structure itself. And they could view from a balcony all that is going on in the temple area. They could view it beautifully. And so Pilate was there in the praetorium. Now, in John's Gospel, it tells us they brought Jesus to the praetorium early in the morning, early in the watch, probably around 5 o'clock in the morning. Now, how do you think Pilate felt about being woken up at 5 in the morning for a religious dispute? He didn't like it. He wasn't on good terms, really, with these people. He tolerated them, but he wasn't on good terms with them. To make it worse, John's Gospel tells us that the high priests, or the priests, the scribes, and so forth, would not walk into the praetorium, lest they be defiled. Now, that was a message to Pilate. Pilate, you have spiritual cooties. We will not come into your building. We will not have anything to do with you. You come out on the balcony to us. So at 5 in the morning, not only would they not come in, he had to get dressed and go out to meet them on the balcony for this religious dispute. So he was in no mood. Yet he's involved. Verse 2, Pilate asked him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" And he answered and said, "It is as you say." The chief priests accused him of many things, but he answered nothing. Then Pilate asked him again, saying, "Do you answer nothing? See how many things they testify against you." Why were they there? It's not a political issue. There's not an insurrection issue. It's not a social issue. It's purely religious. Pilate knows that. King of the Jews, who cares? I'm a Roman. This is between you and your people. I don't care about this. Jesus does not answer as they bring all these accusations, just like when he stood before the Sanhedrin at Caiaphas' house. So Pilate speaks up. Don't you hear their accusations? In Luke's gospel, there were three accusations that these scribes, chief priests, and so forth brought to Pilate. It says in Luke 23, "And they began to accuse him, saying, 'We have found this man subverting the nation. He opposes payment of taxes to Caesar, and he claims to be Christ the King.'" Now, charge number one, he is subverting the nation. That was a false charge. Jesus said, "Don't think I have come to destroy the law. I've come to fulfill it." He kept the law. He was a law-abiding citizen. He kept original Jewish law. He attended the festivals. He was not subverting the nation. Second charge, he opposes the payment of taxes to Caesar. Was that true? No. Jesus said, "Look at this coin. Whose mug is on it?" "Caesar's mug." Well, if Caesar's face is on it, give what belongs to Caesar to him, and give what belongs to God to him. He wasn't opposing payment of taxes. In other words, pay your taxes. He told Peter, "Go down to the Sea of Galilee. Cast out your line. The first fish you get, you'll open its mouth. There will be a coin that you can use to pay your taxes." Boy, I'd love if that happened today, wouldn't you? Just a check for the right amount. You go fishing or something like that, and boom, there it is. Well, it happened for Peter. The third charge is that he claims to be the Messiah. Was that a true charge? You betcha. "Are you the Christ?" the Sanhedrin asked him. "Yes, I am. And you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of God." In other words, he will judge you. "I am the Christ." Verse 5, "But Jesus still answered nothing, so that Pilate marveled." The Greek word thaumazo, to be held in admiration. He was awestricken. Here's a guy accused of all these charges. He just stands there. Has not one word to say. Now keep in mind, Pilate had seen hundreds of criminals in his time. He's heard hundreds, thousands perhaps, of accusations. He's probably heard criminals on their own defense say, "That's a lie! I demand justice! I've never done that!" And cry out some kind of a defense. Jesus said nothing. And so it says, Pilate marveled. Now, why did not Jesus answer? Well, number one, to fulfill Scripture. It says in Isaiah, as a lamb before her shearers is silent, so he opened not his mouth. Secondly, he knew that he was telling the truth. He knew these were false accusations. He also knew that Pilate knew they were false accusations. In fact, the Scripture records that. Jesus, he said, is an innocent man. Jesus knew that he knew. Jesus knew that he knew, personally. Why say anything? We both know these are false accusations. So he didn't say a word. I tell you what, I so admire, as I read the New Testament, in every situation, I never read Jesus getting ruffled or like it's out of control and losing perspective, panicking. You ever read of Jesus panicking? I read of Jesus angry, turning over tables, but he was fully in control. He didn't fly off the handle. He didn't panic. There's this calm assurance. That's great. He's in control. He never panics. We do. And sometimes we wonder why he does it. God, what's wrong with you? You should be upset. You ever had a friend or a spouse or a child or somebody close to you kind of get upset at you when they panic and you don't? What's wrong with you? You should be as worried as I am. God, what's wrong? Nothing. I'm in control. I don't have anything to worry about. I'm not panicking. I knew all about this before it even happened. Completely in control. Now at the feast, he, that is Pilate, was accustomed to releasing one prisoner to them, whomever they requested. There was one named Barabbas, who was chained with his fellow insurrectionists. That is, he caused a rebellion, a revolt against Rome. They had committed murder in the insurrection. Some terrorist group, maybe they hijacked a camel train and murdered somebody while they did it, but some kind of a rebellion. And he was in prison for a known crime. Then the multitude, crying aloud, began to ask him to do just as he had always done for them. But Pilate answered them, saying, do you want me to release to you the king of the Jews? For he knew that the chief priests had handed him over because of envy. But the chief priests stirred up the crowd so that he should release Barabbas to them. And Pilate answered and said to them again, what then do you want me to do with him who is called King of the Jews? Some scholars have an interesting idea. They have found certain documents that show Barabbas' name to be Jesus Barabbas. Jesus is a very common name. Barabbas, Bar, means son in Hebrew. Abba means father or daddy in Hebrew. Barabbas or Barabbas means son of the father. Do you want me to release to you Jesus, son of the father? It could be, some have even proposed that he claimed to be a Messiah, the Messiah of the Jews. And he had a group of people following him, ready to take over the Roman government. Who do you want? Barabbas, son of the father? Or Jesus, son of the father, Barabbas? Or Jesus, the King of the Jews, who says he's the Son of God? Which one? Give us Barabbas, they cried. What shall I do with him whom you call the King of the Jews? They cried out again, crucify him. Now this is the crowd, the Jewish crowd. The court has been set, Pilate's involved, religious people involved, accusations. And so he gives it out to the people. Let's put it to a vote. Let's see what the people will say. Now you'd think that the people would say, let him go. A few days ago when he came into Jerusalem, we all said, Hosanna! Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. Now they say, crucify him, crucify him. Why? Well, he didn't dance to their drumbeat, that's why. They expected the Messiah, if he's the Messiah, to get stuff done, take over, kick out the Roman government, be in charge, rule from Mount Zion. Here's this guy seemingly weak, inept. Oh, crucify him. You know, crowds are so fickle. They'll clap one moment, they'll boo the next. That's why Jesus was so wise when even in Jerusalem, in John chapter 2 and 3, it says, when the crowd came and followed him because they saw the miracles that Jesus did, it says Jesus didn't even commit himself to that group because he knew the heart of men. They were in it simply for the miraculous. What can you do for me? What can you give me? I'll follow you as long as I get what I want. When I don't get what I want, it's over. So Jesus didn't even commit himself to them. He was wise. Pilate said to them, "Why? What evil has he done?" And they cried out the more exceedingly, "Crucify him." When you don't have a good argument, you yell louder. And he asked them a very good question. They should have been able to answer it. Well, you say, "Crucify him." Why? What reason? What do you think he's done? All they did is cry out, "Crucify him." They had no argument. They had no good response. They just got more emotional. As people who don't think well or can't make it through the argument will often do, they'll just get rattled and "Crucify him." They just got louder, more vehemently. They cried out. They had no charge. Now, here's a problem. And we need the help of other gospels at this point to fill us in. Because the people, the crowd, the chief priests will make an accusation to Pilate, sort of. Pilate has been the Roman procurator for about 5 years now in Judea. He's had some problems. He was directly responsible to the Roman emperor. But he's already had some problems and he's on thin ice politically. And he is the consummate politician. He doesn't care about doing what's right, as most politicians I have found. He cares about getting the votes. He wants to stay in his position. Unfortunately, they didn't have term limits back then. You just stay as long as the emperor lets you. And anyway, here's the problem. When he first came into office, Pilate made mistake number one. He didn't know the Jews very well. He had his soldiers march into Jerusalem and carry ensigns, insignias of the emperor, with his picture on it. Now, to a Jew, that is a heinous, blasphemous thing, because the law of Moses says, you will have no graven images of men or of birds or of beasts or of anything that represents something that you would bow down and worship. And since the Roman government ascribed deity to Caesar, they saw this as blasphemy. It's a graven image, something that you're using to worship. That's how the Jews viewed it. They protested Pilate's bringing this bust of Caesar, these ensigns of Caesar, into Jerusalem. They said, they formal protest. What did Pilate do? Pilate herds all of the Jews into an amphitheater, has the soldiers pull out their swords, and says, "One more word of protest, we're going to cut your heads off." The Jews, and he didn't know they would do this, bowed to the ground and bared their necks. All of them. In other words, we're willing to die for this. This is blasphemy. Kill us. At that point, Pilate knew. It's a moment of truth. He said, "Wow, these are not ordinary people. They're willing to die for this little image thing." He pulled the ensigns out of Jerusalem. He lost face. The emperor heard about it. Demerit number one. Demerit number two came a few years later, when Pilate forcibly took money from the temple treasury in Jerusalem. Belonged to the Jews for the upkeep of the temple, the priests, the sacrifices. Took money to build an aqueduct to carry water to Jerusalem. The Jews protested directly to the emperor in Rome. This is demerit number two. Strike three came right before this, when he had the soldiers, he gave them new shields, and on the shields again was a bust of Caesar. He wanted to please Tiberius, the Caesar, the emperor in Rome. And so he had a bust of them on the shields that the soldiers would carry. At this point, the Jews, instead of protesting Pilate, again sent direct mail, kind of direct messenger to Rome, and issued their formal complaint in Rome. Caesar Tiberius commanded Pilate to desist. So he's on thin ice. One more false move could mean his career and possibly his life. Now, I share all that background with you because you can understand how Pilate felt when the Jews, as recorded in one of the other Gospels, In John's gospel, in fact, the Jews came to Pilate at this point and said, "If you let this man go, you are not Caesar's friend." Oh, don't say that. You let this man go, you're not Caesar's friend. We got you over a barrel, dude. Three strikes already. We're going to let Caesar know about this. You're not going to be his friend if you let this man go. And so, being the consummate politician, the scripture says the Pilate gave in to them. And the voices of the people prevailed. He gave them their wishes and let Jesus be crucified. Verse 15. So Pilate, wanting to gratify the crowd. Oh, how sad. Wanting to gratify the crowd. We really care, don't we, about what people think about us. Will they accept us into their group? What will their opinion be when they see me, when I talk? Will they accept me at work? Will they let me be a part with them? Will they think I'm cool? What things can I do to show that I am really cool? Because I want to be accepted by the crowd. Christians, you need to quit worrying about what the world thinks of you. You need to stand up for truth, righteousness. Who cares about being politically correct? Big deal. You're not called to please any special interest groups. Please God. Stand up for truth, the Word of God. Will the world scoff at you? Yes, let them. Let it come, man. I don't care. Because one day I will stand before God. I will not stand before the gay rights committees, before the governors, before the presidents, before the prime ministers, or before any little group. I'm going to stand before God, and I'm going to give an account to Him. So I want to have a clear conscience that, as Paul said, am I trying to please men or God? If I was trying to please men, I could not be the servant of Christ. Be not conformed to this world, Romans 12, 2 and 3 tell us, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Don't let the world squeeze you into its mold. You know, Jesus was countercultural. He was a radical. He didn't fit in. He wasn't the typical. The religious people hated Him for that. They couldn't get a grip on Him. They couldn't control Him. Be a radical. But be a radical in love, not for the sake of being radical. Don't be different and radical for the sake of being different because you have kind of a problem with identification and so who cares? Do it in love. Will the world hate you? Love them back. It'll drive them nuts. Love them for Christ's sake. So Pilate, wanting to gratify the crowd, released Barabbas to them and he delivered Jesus after he scourged him to be crucified. Now what does that mean to be scourged? It means they took an implement called a flagellum. Had a little wooden handle about 6 to 8 inches long. Tied to it were leather straps, thongs, anywhere from 12 to 18 inches long. So the whole thing was about 2 feet. Tied into the leather straps, the thongs, were pieces of glass, metal, bone. It was very sharp. And it's a very cruel form of torture. They would beat the criminals after stretching them over a pole. The back was stretched taut like a drum. So that when, and it was used at full force, when the Roman soldier would haul back and release that flagellum, it would grip the flesh. It would stick. It would embed itself into the epidermis and even the subcutaneous tissues. And then the Roman soldier would pull back. And it would rip, serrate the flesh. It was done so that the criminal would confess to the crimes for which he was accused. If he was guilty, of course, he would confess probably after one, maybe even no stripes at all. Again, Jesus had no crime. Many of them died during this beating. Jesus took the full brunt of it. By His stripes, we are healed. Eusebius, a church historian in his book, Ecclesiastical History, has a description about the martyrs who were beaten with this flagellum. He said, quote, "They were torn by scourges down to the deep-seated veins and the arteries, so that the hidden contents of the recesses of their bodies, their entrails, and their organs were exposed to sight. Now, we don't know how deeply this affected Jesus, but we know that this experience weakened him so much that he couldn't even do what a normal criminal could do, and that is carry one portion of his cross from the praetorium all the way to Calvary, which is not far of a walk. I've walked it many times. You can do it in a few minutes. He couldn't do it. He fell because of the weight of the cross. He'd lost so much blood. Isaiah, looking down through history into the New Testament, said concerning Jesus Christ that he didn't even have the same appearance as a man anymore. His appearance, he said, was so disfigured beyond that of any man, and his form was marred beyond human likeness. And so Jesus was weakened by the process. The Romans gave 40 lashes. They changed it to 39 later on for the sake of mercy. 40 is judgment, minus 1 is the number of mercy. So let's temper justice or judgment with mercy. Jesus took all 39. Then the soldiers led him away to the hall called the Praetorium. It's back again after the beating in the courtyard. And they called together the whole garrison. In Jerusalem, they have discovered, and again, this is one of the few places that you could point to and say, Jesus Christ walked here. There's a lot of places they'll show you, this is where Jesus did this. And it's all confusing today because it's been a long time ago. You know, dirt blows away. And we don't have any eyewitness accounts where people are, yeah, just yesterday I saw Jesus walking here. So there's very few authentic places that you can say on this very spot. There's one, however, that is well authenticated. That is the Praetorium. The very pavement, which the word originally means, the pavement, has been found, and they've built a building over it to preserve it. And you can walk on the very same stone that was there 2,000 years ago that Pilate presided over and Jesus Christ stood upon for judgment. It's still there, even the markings in the stone. And there's a game they found called the King's Game, where they would roll dice and play this game for the soldiers who are being tried. You can still see it today. Verse 17, they clothed him with purple. They twisted a crown of thorns. They put it on his head. They began to salute him, "Hail, King of the Jews." Did you know that the only crown Jesus Christ ever wore on this earth was a crown of thorns? It's the only crown he ever wore. He's the King of Kings. Now, why a crown of thorns? There's a lot of reasons. The soldiers made a game out of it. Oh, he's a king. Let's give him a crown. They pulled a crown of thorns. But I believe that it was really symbolic, figurative, and even prophetic. When man sinned, God cursed the earth. He said, thorns and thistles will it bring from this day forward. Jesus wore upon his head, and it caused him to bleed, the very thing that the earth was. Man's sin cursed the earth. God cursed the earth because of man's sin. Now Jesus is wearing, so to speak, the result of the curse of man's sin upon his brow. That which was cursed, he's wearing. Now next time he comes, he'll wear a diadem. In fact, diademata is the Greek word, several glorious crowns, Revelation 19. You can read about it. Verse 19, they struck him on the head with the reed and spat on him, bowing the knee, and they worshipped him. And as I said, you can see in Jerusalem on the pavement a game still carved in from 2,000 years ago, one of the many games that the Roman soldiers would play with the prisoner. And many believe that that was one of the games that is mentioned here in this whole mockery of Jesus Christ in the Praetorium. They mocked him. They took his purple robe off him. I don't know if you understand the significance of that. When you bleed, like on your back, you not only secrete blood, but lymph. And lymph that comes to heal that area is very tacky, sticky substance. And it dries rapidly. Have you ever scraped yourself and you notice kind of a yellowy fluid that comes and kind of cakes over, glosses over that cut? That's lymph. And you touch it, it's real tacky. Imagine putting a robe on Jesus' back after being scourged, caked with blood and lymph. Going back to the Praetorium after the flogging, the games are played with him. That's quite a walk. By this time, no doubt, that blood and lymph has hardened, settling in. To remove the robe, have you ever removed a bandage before it's totally healed? And it pulls and freshens up that wound again? So they took the purple off him and put on his own clothes and led him to crucify him. Now they compelled a certain man, Simon, a Cyrenian from North Africa, the father of Alexander and Rufus, as he was coming out of the country passing by, to bear his cross. They brought him to the place called Golgotha, which is translated place of a skull. Golgotha is the Hebrew term. The Greek term is cranion or cranium. The Latin term is calvarium, where we get the word Calvary chapel. Sometimes I can tell how religiously astute people are when if we're doing business for some kind, and I say, it's Calvary Chapel, and they spell it C-A-L-V-E-R-Y, or they put Cavalry Chapel, like we're Confederate soldiers. Calvarium, the skull. That's what we get the word Calvary, the place where Jesus was crucified. In the Hebrew, it's Golgotha. It was given the name because of its shape. If you go to Israel and you look over at this area outside the Damascus Gate, it is plain as it was 2,000 years ago, solid rock. You can look, and if you stand at the Damascus Gate and look over, you can see the sunken eyes, the nose, and the mouth, and it's a perfect skull. It was the place of the skull, out of solid limestone. It's part of Mount Moriah, and it's very plain to see. Today, there's an Arab bus station that sort of covers it. You have to stand up on the wall or get around and see it a little bit. And a lot of people have gone over and said, "Oh, this is horrible. Look at the put a bus station right here where Jesus was crucified." Actually, I think it's very fitting. Don't you? Jesus was crucified at that kind of a place. It was an execution. It wasn't a pretty little garden with a little winding road up the hill. And if, you know, little flowers around it, as sometimes the scene depicts, it was a public place where people would travel. It was at the crossroads outside the Damascus Gate. And you'd go outside, and in plain sight at this crossroads, at the intersection, so to speak, Jesus was crucified. The Romans would crucify in plain sight at a public place where the most traffic was. Why? As a message to people who would think, you know, I'm going to start my own riot against Rome. Think again, buddy. Look what happens to people who cause any kind of problems with Rome. They get thrown on a cross. When somebody was sentenced to be crucified, a soldier would lead the procession. He would carry a placard. And on the placard was written the crimes of this person. What he was accused for: murder, theft, rioting, insurrection, whatever they put it on. Now, Jesus' placard was, "This is Jesus of Nazareth, the King of the Jews." And they walked the longest possible route carrying the cross so that the city folks could look down and see, here's a criminal, here's somebody who's defied Rome. This is what happens to him as a public display. So they brought him to the place of Golgotha, which is translated the place of the skull. Now, you should also know that this is a significant place historically. As I said, it belongs to Mount Moriah. Now, let me draw a picture with my hands, okay? I don't have a blackboard, so I'll draw a picture with my hands. Let's say you're looking at Jerusalem. You're looking at the Temple Mount. And let's say you're there in the time of Abraham. And you look, and you see there's a valley all around. There's a mountain. It kind of slopes up like this. It rises up, and then it tapers down. It's more tapered on this side than this side, and then it kind of levels off. Now, as you're looking at it, that mountain that you see was Mount Moriah. That was a place that God showed Abraham and said, "Take your son, your only son whom you love, and sacrifice him there on Mount Moriah." The angel stopped his arm. Years later, David sees, now this is a perfect spot to take the tabernacle out of this tent and put it in a temple. I'm going to build God a house. And on top of that Mount Moriah, there is a threshing floor. Solid bedrock. There's a threshing floor. It belongs to Araunah or Ornan, depending if you read Chronicles or Kings. I'm going to go to him and ask him if I can buy it. "Hey, Ornan, hi, this is King David. Can I buy that threshing floor? I want to build God a house." "Hey, sure, David. In fact, I'll give it to you." "No, I'm going to buy it. Not going to give God anything unless it costs me something." So they settle a price. David can't build the temple. Solomon builds the temple. Now, for 500 years, once the temple is built there on Moriah, for 500 years, sacrifices are brought to that place. Lambs are brought. Blood is shed. Sins are atoned for. As you look at the mountain, again, you see it sloping. Right here is the temple. On the other side of the temple, it continues to rise. A section of it is cut out for quarrying purposes, and a wall is built around it. If you were to walk to Calvary, Mount Calvary today, you could see it from the Mount of Olives. It rises up. The very peak of Mount Moriah, or the Temple Mount, is Golgotha. It's the very top of the mountain before it descends again. Now, keeping that in mind, remember the prophecy. The scene, Abraham and Isaac. Go to Mount Moriah and take your only son whom you love. That in and of itself is odd. Was Isaac Abraham's only son? He had another son named Ishmael, who was born first. Why does God call him his only son? Well, he was the son of promise. Take your only son whom you love. Did he love Ishmael? Of course he did. The Bible says, and he loved Ishmael. But take your son, your only son whom you love. The very first time the word love is used in the Bible, it is used by God to a father about ready to sacrifice his only son, God calls him, on Mount Moriah. The angel holds it back. He's not able to sacrifice. And Abraham said, in the mountain of the Lord it shall be seen. Jehovah Jireh, he called it. The Lord will provide. In the mountain of the Lord it will be seen. On the very peak of Mount Moriah, thousands of years later, God did not get restrained from sacrificing his only son on the very same place. On the place where sacrifices were made for thousands of years to atone for the sins of the world, Jesus Christ was killed. You can see it. It's the topography is very obvious when you're there. That's where Jesus was crucified. Atop Moriah. Atop the peak of the Temple Mount. Outside, barely outside the city gates. They gave him, verse 23, wine mingled with myrrh to drink, but he did not take it. This is an anesthetic. It's meant to dull the pain. The criminals were often given drugs, basically, so that they wouldn't have to feel the brunt of the pain. It would take the edge off of it. Jesus refused it. Oh, when we think what Jesus went through for us, refusing to have the pain blunted, taking the full brunt of the judgment of God upon his body, not only was the pain excruciating, but he will say in a few sentences more, my God, why have you forsaken me? And so we're going slowly here. This is holy ground. He did not take it. When they crucified him, they divided his garments, casting lots for them to determine what every man should take. Crucifixion was not invented by the Jews. The Jews despised the cross. They hated it. The Romans did not invent crucifixion. The Persians did. And a group of barbaric Persians were the first to use it. It's a brutal, in fact, perhaps the most brutal form of death. It deliberately delays death until maximum torture is felt. It usually took several days of a criminal hanging on that Roman gibbet before he finally died, totally exasperated, loss of blood. But it was meant to delay death until maximum torture could be felt. Now the cross, people were crucified in a few different ways. There was first of all a vertical pole, a tree, vertical, and the prisoner would be suspended on it, his arms tied above his head and nails driven into it and in the feet on a vertical stake. Sometimes there was a cross that was done in the form of an X. The arms would be stretched, the legs would be equally as stretched. The most common form, it's just a new word. You can do that in English. You can just take certain words, put them together, and make up your own. Try it sometime. It works. The Fomin cross, the common form of the cross, was a vertical stake with a horizontal stake placed above it, where the feet were tied together and the arms were stretched out. Probably that was the cross that Jesus died upon. Rome reserved the cross for the worst kind of criminals. You had to be a murderer. You had to be a political insurrectionist. You had to be a real bad, wicked person to do it. If you were a Roman citizen, even if you were a murderer, they wouldn't crucify you. It was reserved for slaves or non-Romans. Listen to what Cicero said. He said, quote, "To bind a Roman citizen is a crime. To flog a Roman citizen is an abomination. To kill a Roman citizen is an act of murder. To crucify him, what? There is no fitting word that can possibly describe so horrible a deed." Even one Roman senator said, "The very word cross should be removed from Roman citizens' thoughts." So the cross was despised by the Jews. So to see a Messiah dying on a cross, oh, perish the thought, it could never happen. And they gave him wine mingled with myrrh to drink. He did not take it. When they crucified him, they divided his garments, casting lots for them to determine what every man should take. Also fulfilling prophecy. Now it was the third hour, and they crucified him. And the inscription of his accusation was written above, "The King of the Jews." You have to have a harmony of the Gospels. One of the Gospels says, "This is Jesus." Another one says, "This is Jesus of Nazareth." Here it says, "The King of the Jews." You say, boy, is this kind of a conflict? Not at all. Mark had a purpose different than Matthew had a purpose, different than John had a purpose, different than Luke, all portraying Jesus differently for a specific purpose. Jesus was seen as the servant, the one who fulfilled the prophecies also of being a servant. You put it all together, the sign read, "This is Jesus of Nazareth, the King of the Jews." That's the first gospel tract ever written. People would see that as they walked by. The thieves on the cross would read that as Jesus was crucified in the middle. With him they also crucified two robbers, one on his right, the other on his left. So the scripture was fulfilled, which says, "And he was numbered with the transgressors." Now the word robber here literally means bandits who plunder after they steal. It's not just a petty thief. He didn't like pick up gum in the market or rip off a guy's CD player. It's someone who, after they would steal, would victimize or plunder. They wanted to torture their victims, many of them. Very wicked men. Another gospel, it's Matthew's gospel. Kagaguros is the word Matthew uses. Evil working men. They're crucified, one on either side. Jesus is in the middle. That's a cross reserved for Barabbas, not Jesus. But there's one on the right and one on the left. So the scripture was fulfilled, which says he was numbered with the transgressors. Now, it was no accident that these two fellas were crucified with Jesus. In fact, it was an appointment. There are no accidents in God's kingdom. Well, it's just by fluke that this person came. No, it wasn't. It seems that way. God had an appointment. Remember when Jesus went to Samaria? The woman said, "Jews have no dealings with Samaritans." But it says before that, Jesus needed to go through Samaria. He had an appointment with that woman, that crass woman who wanted nothing to do with Jesus. Jesus wanted to save her. And same with one of these thieves. The Gospels record that one of the thieves breaks out and says, "You know, if you're the Christ, get us down from the cross as well as yourself." Another man says, "Don't you fear God? We deserve this. He's done nothing wrong." And he said, "Lord, remember me when you come into your kingdom." What did Jesus say? "Today, you will be with me in paradise." That's awesome. It's also sad. Here's two guys, one on either side of Jesus, both equally as close. Jesus equally as accessible. One is lost forever in his sins. One is saved that very day. They heard the same things. They saw the same things. One heart was different than the other heart. They both could have been saved. They were both as close to Jesus. They heard the people say, "He says he's the Christ." They probably heard that and said, "Really? He says he's the Christ? Wow." They're thinking about that one. I wonder. They saw that sign. "This is Jesus of Nazareth, King of the Jews." Wow, I wonder who's this guy? He did save others. What did he do? And one guy started thinking, and he finally said, remember me when you come into your kingdom. He remembered, he saw in that moment that Jesus was who he obviously claimed to be. He knew that Jesus had a kingdom, and he knew that Jesus could save him. How exactly he knew all that, we don't know. Perhaps he had gotten wind of Jesus through his ministry. But here's a guy who cried out, and Jesus saved him. And that day he died, he was in heaven. And he's still there. You'll meet him one day. The other one was lost forever. Now we'll close with that because it illustrates something perfectly. The cross demonstrates what depth God will go to save you. Jesus was born in a stable. He grew up in a rejected town called Nazareth. He went to a death on a Roman cross so that his blood could cover the sins of all the world by one man's sacrifice. He was perfectly flawless, sinless. He had no spot, he had no blemish. Two men, one cursing Jesus, shaking his fist at him, "Save us, if you're really God, save us." The other guy saying in humility, "Save me. Remember me when you come into your kingdom." Now, which are you? Are you like the person who says, "If there's a God, I want to see it, prove it"? And you harden in your heart? Or do you realize, you know what? I'm a little peon here. I need salvation. I'm not going to boss God around. He's God. He can do whatever he wants. I need his mercy. I need his grace. Lord, remember me when you come into your kingdom. All of you tonight, all of us tonight, are equally close to God as far as accessibility. The only thing is that sin is separating some of us. That can be easily dealt with by humbling ourselves before him. Humbling ourselves under the mighty hand of God. Admitting we need him. Admitting we have sinned. Maybe you have one time made a commitment to Christ. You've taken different paths. You're pretty far away, but you ended up somehow tonight. You're here. You've got questions on your mind, arguments on your mind. But still inside, your heart's aching. That load of guilt is still up there. Those unanswered questions. You'd like to feel free again, clean again. As we said last week, no matter how many steps you've taken away from him, 20, 30, 40, 50, 100, 2,000, it's only one step back. Lord, remember me. Here I am. Save me. Which will you be? Shake your fist at him? Or you put out your hand and say, "I'm drowning, Lord, save me. Remember me now." Jesus did that for this man on the cross.